Will you please pray with me? Oh, Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
Beloved Jesus Christ,
Blessed Master,
Dearest Mother,
Saints and Sages of all religions,
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home. Be thou the only king. Reigning on the throne of my consciousness. Amen. Good evening, everyone, and thank you for coming. I'd like to read from The Science of Religion by Swami Yogananda. It's published in 1924. There's not a shadow of doubt as to the absolute identity of bliss consciousness and God consciousness. Because when we have that bliss consciousness, we feel that our narrow individuality has been transformed and that we have risen above the duality of petty love and hate, pleasure and pain, etc., and have attained a level from which the painfulness and worthlessness of empirical consciousness become glaringly apparent. And we also feel an inward expansion and an all-embracing sympathy for all things. The tumults of the world die away, excitements disappear, and the all-in-one and one-in-all consciousness seems to dawn upon us. A glorious vision of light appears. All imperfections, all angularities sink into nothingness. We seem to be translated into another region, the fountainhead of perennial bliss, the starting point of one unending continuity. Is not bliss consciousness, then, the same as God consciousness, in which God consciousness, the above states of realization seem obvious? It is evident, then, that God cannot be better conceived than as bliss coming within the range of everyone's calm experience. No longer will God be a supposition to be theorized over. Is this not a nobler conception of God? He is perceived as manifesting himself in our hearts in the form of bliss in meditation, in prayerful or worshipful mood. If we conceive of God in this way, i.e. as bliss, then and then only can we make religion universally necessary. For no one can deny that he wishes to get bliss, and if he wishes to get bliss in the proper way, he is going to be religious through approaching and feeling God, who is described as very close to his heart as bliss. This bliss consciousness, or God consciousness, can pervade all our actions and moods if we but let it. If we can get firm hold of this, we shall be able to judge the relative religious worth of every minor action and motive on this earth. If we are once convinced that the attainment of this bliss consciousness is our religion, our goal, our ultimate end, then all doubts as to the meaning of multifarious teachings, injunctions, and prohibitions of different faiths of the world will disappear. Everything will be interpreted in the light of the stage of growth for which it is prescribed. Truth will shine out, the mystery of existence will be solved, and a light will be thrown upon the details of our lives with their various actions and motives. We shall be able to separate the naked truth from the outward appendages of religious doctrines and see the worthlessness of conventions that so often mislead men and create differences between them. Further, if religion is understood in this way, there is no man in the world, be he a boy, youth, or an old person, who cannot practice it whatever may be the station of life to which he belongs, be it a student or a professional life, or be he a lawyer, doctor, carpenter, brazier, scholar, or philanthropist. If to abolish the sense of want and attain bliss is religion, who is there that is not trying to be religious and will not try to be so in a greater degree if proper methods are pointed out? Herein does not arise the question of the variety of religions, that of Christ or Muhammad or of the Hindus. Every one in the world is inevitably trying to be religious and can seek to be more completely so by the adoption of proper means. There is no distinction here of caste or creed, sect or faith, dress or clime, age or sex, profession or position. For this religion is universal. If you said that all the people of the world ought to accept the Lord Krishna as their God, would all the Christians and the Mohammedans accept that? If you ask everyone to take Jesus as their Lord, would all the Hindus and Mohammedans do that? And again, if you bade all accept Mohammed as their Lord, would all Christians and Hindus agree to that? But if you say, "Oh, my Christian, Mohammedan, and Hindu brethren, your Lord God is ever blissful consciousness existence," will they not accept this? Can they possibly reject it? Will they not demand him as the only one who can put an end to all their miseries? Nor can one escape this conclusion by saying that Christians, Hindus, or Mohammedans do not conceive Jesus, Krishna, or Muhammad respectively as their Lord God. They are thought to be only the standard bearers of God, the human incarnations of divinity. What if one thinks that way? Is it not the physical body of Jesus, Krishna, or Muhammad that we are primarily interested in? Nor are we so much concerned with the historical place they occupy? Nor are they immemorable to us because of their different and interesting ways of preaching God. We revere them because they knew and felt God. Knew and felt God. It is that fact that interests us in their historical existence and in their manifold ways of expressing the truth. They might or might not be on the same plane. Let the hard-shelled theologians and difference-hunters in religion fight over that question eternally and vainly. But did they not belong to a more or less close family of God? Did they not all realize God as bliss and reveal real blessedness as true godliness? Is not that a sufficient bond of unity among them, let alone other aspects of godhood and truth they might have realized and expressed? Shouldn't a Christian, a Hindu, and a Mohammedan find a mutual interest in each other's prophets, inasmuch as each of them cherished in his heart God consciousness as primarily superior bliss consciousness? As God unites all religions, is it not the conception and realization of him as bliss, if not anything else, that unites the consciousness of the prophets of all religions? One should not think that this conception of God is too abstract, having nothing to do with our spiritual hopes and aspirations, which require the conception of God as a personal being. It is not the conception of an impersonal being as commonly understood, nor that of a personal being as narrowly conceived. God is not a person as we are in our narrowness. Our being, consciousness, feeling, volition have but a shadow of resemblance of his being, existence, consciousness, and anandam. He is a person in the transcendental sense. Our being, consciousness, feeling are limited and empirical. His are unlimited and transcendental. Nor should he be thought of as abstract, absolute, impersonal, unconditional, remote, and beyond the reach of all experience, even our inner one. He, as I have remarked, comes within the calm experience of men. It is in bliss consciousness that we realize him. There can be no other direct proof of his existence. It is in him as bliss that our spiritual hopes and aspirations find fulfillment, Our devotion and love find an object. No other conception of a personal being who is nothing but ourselves, magnified, is required for us. God may be or become anything, personal, impersonal, all-merciful, omnipotent, etc., etc. What we say is that we do not require to take note of these. Whatever conception we have put forth exactly suits our purposes, our hopes, our aspirations, and our perfection. Nor should we think that this conception of God will make us dreamy idealists, severing our connection with the duties and responsibilities, joys and sorrows of this practical world. If God is bliss, and if we seek bliss to know Him, we cannot neglect the duties and responsibilities of the world. In the performance of them, we can still feel bliss, for it is beyond them, and so they cannot affect it. We transcend the joys and sorrows of the world in bliss, but we cannot transcend the duties and responsibilities in the sense of neglecting them. For in doing everything, eating, drinking, seeing, hearing, feeling, smelling, tasting, sorrowing, feeling pleasure, performing every minute duty of the world, we do nothing. We eat, drink, see, hear, feel, smell, taste, nothing. We feel no sorrow nor pleasure. We remain unattached. All actions flow from our nature that is human. We, bathed in an unending bliss, feel ourselves to be the dispassionate seer of all our actions. Our narrow egoism vanishes. The all-ego dawns, and bliss spreads through our being. We feel that we are playing our appointed parts on the stage of the world without being inwardly affected by the weal and woe, love and hate that the playing of the part involves. I'd like to speak this evening of one God, one religion. In the times that we are going through with the many divisions in religions, one God, one religion seems perhaps a distant dream. It is a dream that Yogananda often spoke of, always held in his heart. It is a dream that our dearest mother cherished above all others, that mankind would come to the point where he would realize that all men everywhere are reaching out in an impulse to find God. When we define God as bliss, then we have defined Him correctly. The bliss that we find within our own being is the bliss of God, and when we touch that, we touch the entirety of God. Mother used to say, when you put your feet upon the earth, you touch all the earth. And in the same way, when you touch one aspect of God, you are in touch with the whole of God. Now, you may not consciously be aware of the totality of God, for God is infinite. And that is beyond the conception and the comprehension of most of our minds. In order to know God as the infinite being that He is, we would have to completely transcend the human sense of mind. And that is why in the Bible it says that no man has ever seen God. Man, in his normal human thinking state, finds God beyond his conception in his eternal, unlimited aspect of spirit. But there are states of consciousness that exist beyond our normal thinking state. I remember a time of being uplifted into consciousness. It was a wonderful experience where I transcended through the third eye point, and it felt and experienced and saw myself going out as if a wave out on a huge, vast ocean. And the wave began to expand in every direction. And as that wave expanded, so did my consciousness. The expanse was something beyond description. The peace was tremendous, and yet there was movement within the stillness. It took on a life of its own, in that I was a witness to what I was experiencing. That bliss, that peace, that light, expanding and expanding and going through mutations and transmutations, was the source of my being as I realized it. And at once I had a certain perspective, a certain place that I was looking from as a witness, and in another sense, my consciousness became all-pervading. Both existed. I existed as a human being in a human body, and yet I existed as this vast wave of consciousness. The mind is so accustomed to duality, to thinking that I am this and not that, that it has a difficult time conceiving of being all, of being everything. We oftentimes speak of the death of the ego, and people put their own twist, their own spin upon that kind of imagery, that kind of thought. Many times people conceive that as themselves no longer being in existence, and that only God exists, and that somehow the consciousness that they were no longer exists at all, and that is becoming God realized. Well, that is the material mind's thought of what death is. And it does not relate to what God consciousness is. God consciousness is all consciousness. And when you encapsulate your consciousness within a human consciousness, then it is as if you are a tiny bubble floating in a vast sea of consciousness. And your consciousness then is identified with that tiny bubble. When it's identified with that tiny bubble, it excludes the rest of the sea of consciousness of which you are a part. And therefore you imprison yourself in this tiny, narrow consciousness. Now it varies a great deal within human experience of how expansive, how open any particular consciousness is. If somebody is experiencing a great deal of depression, their consciousness can be narrowed down to a pinpoint, a little tiny cave in which they exist, that is hardly bigger than a speck. And to them, the reality has become just that size, just that narrow. For another individual, it seems that the world is a wide open place. They enjoy nature. They enjoy looking out over vast expanses. They see possibilities. They see potential, both for themselves and for other people. Their consciousness, in the human sense, is far more expansive than the person who has been experiencing depression. And yet, even that human consciousness that is expansive, that is embracing, falls far short of what the divine all-consciousness is and can be experienced through that deeper meditation of Ananda, of bliss. It is only through going in deeply and experiencing that inner peace where the joy begins to erupt spontaneously within your own being. It comes perhaps at first just like a tiny bubble floating up to the surface. It can be just a hint of joy within that quiet. And then that joy begins to expand out. That tiny bubble begins to move out beyond your body consciousness, almost unnoticed by you. Because your consciousness, when identified with the greater cosmic consciousness, automatically feels as if that is its own, its very own. And you don't feel like you've become something else or someone else. It's only when you contrast that expanded state of consciousness with the smaller human state of consciousness that you were experiencing before, do you realize at times that you have entered into something greater, something bigger. It is like stepping out of a small room and into a larger room and just automatically adjusting to that larger room. And pretty soon the larger room seems to itself to be smaller. And you step into a larger room still. And very quickly your mind adjusts to that larger room. It's not until you enter into the smaller rooms from which you've come out of that you realize how much larger, how much more expansive are the other rooms that you've been in. Because they seem so familiar. They seem so much a part of yourself. There are times in meditation when we have that expansive consciousness, and yet we don't fully recognize it at that moment because it feels so natural. And it's not until the consciousness somehow gets translated back into a smaller sphere, perhaps of tension and fear and anxiety, that we realize what great sense of peace, what great sense of joy we were experiencing before. These experiences are to be treasured. They are to be valued. Any time you feel that uplifting current within you, there may be a part of your mind that goes into an automatic denial of a sort. It begins to minimize that experience, marginalize it. And this is a negative trait within our minds. Rather, we should take whatever is given to us and rejoice in it, to pay attention to it, to allow the mind to expand with it, to cultivate it in every way possible. Anytime that you experience any joy for any reason, acknowledge that. Let it become bolder within your mind. Let it uplift you. Let it transform you. That joy, that ananda, is God within you. And when we worship that above all other things, all other conceptions of joy, joy that comes through worldly accomplishment, joy that comes through having power, joy that comes through intoxicants and food and all the other enjoyments that we get through this world. Those are bliss also, but you can say they are ananda with a small a, or bliss with a small b. The bliss that we get with God is bliss with a capital B, ananda with a capital A. It is the superior joy because it is not dependent on external circumstances. That joy is your nature. That joy is part of you. It is you. And it is God. And through that joy, through that ananda, you can experience your oneness with God. Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that what the world is looking for in all of its various ways of seeking real happiness, real joy, real bliss? And this world is like one vast human laboratory of experimentation, looking for that lasting joy and upliftment. And everyone has a slightly different theory on how to attain it. And they are playing that out in their lives. Each person is doing that, no matter how convoluted it may look from your perspective. But when people get focused upon religion as an end instead of a means to an end, as a political movement versus the search for joy, as a identity to take on, to wear like you would some suit of clothes, and not finding that joy, not finding that upliftment and bliss, then those leaders who teach the pursuit of finding God within an organization or finding God within some limited sphere or means, they are responsible for what they do. as each one of us are responsible. The leaders of this world, the leaders of religion, must recognize that it is through this Ananda that people will find their ultimate fulfillment. Many are threatened because there is no way to put a copyright on this. There's no way for an organization to claim exclusive rights to it. There is no way for a religion to say that they can be the only one. This is not possible. And so many reject it. Many push it away. But in our simplicity, in our direct path towards God, we can claim it fully and completely for ourselves. We need not go anywhere. We need not do anything in particular other than go within the lavatory of our own being, open ourselves to that blissful, joyful experience, and receive that which we are given. This is the price of entry. And all of our meditation techniques, all of the methods that we are given, are all geared to take us into that inner temple of silence, that inner temple of peace. And when we take advantage of those methods, and we go with deepened prayer into that temple of silence, that temple of peace, then we will feel that feeling of God that can come as some joy or some peace or a sense of upliftment, feeling that presence, feeling it right now within your own being and wherever you feel it at, to whatever degree you feel it, let it grow, let it expand within you. You can't force it, but you can allow it. You can take away the barriers that are self-imposed. You can expand the limitations that we ourselves have created. And that joy, that peace, that feeling of that presence can expand out beyond your own body. Can feel it grow and expand. Not something different from you, not something outside of you, but you yourself, your body, instead of being this tiny physical form, becomes this entire world. And when people walk upon the ground, they're walking upon you. And you can let it expand and grow even more, out into the stars, into the solar system, into the galaxies and the constellations, and just allow your mind and your consciousness and your spirit to soar. You don't need to go anywhere. You don't need to be on vacation. You don't need to go to India or any other place. That sacred holy of holies is right within you. That sanctum sanctorum is right within your own soul. And when you enter into it and allow your spirit to rise and expand, you become one with that, as you become one with God. You do not need to make your conception of God so much a something that's other than you that you feel like you can never touch that, never be that. You are that, even this moment, even if you feel the limitation. Even if you feel confined, you are still God in human form. You are that. I am that I am. You are the great I am within your own being. You are the great self within you. And even if you experience limitation or pain or difficulty, think to yourself, who is it who's experiencing that pain, that difficulty, that limitation. Who is it within? And you will find that there is a self, that there is a presence, that there is a witness, that is something different from the difficulties, from the limitations. And when you touch in with that, just identify that in your own mind, you will feel a greater sense of stillness, a greater sense of peace. And from that, that is your touchstone. That is the place to go to that will expand and uplift your soul and make you know that you are one. With the increasing purity of your consciousness, you will know in greater and greater degrees your sense of oneness with that divine presence, that unlimited source from which you have sprung. And it is wonderful, it is beautiful, and it is you, and nothing else. And you have always been that, and you will always be that. So you see, it's not so hard. Are there any questions about your sadhana or anything I've spoken about? I think that's particularly difficult when we're first feeling that sense of peace and upliftment, that we feel the contrast. We might be in a state of meditation. And in that sense of peace that we feel in that meditative state, we're then at some point, through necessity or desire, directed to move out into the world. And as soon as we move out into the world, we feel the vibrations of others, the demands from the world, and suddenly we're drawn outside of that sense of peace, that sense of bliss. In the beginning, that is what we're able to do at that time. We take it as far as we can. We move out. We take that peace with us into the world. It is probably inevitable in those early stages that we will feel that separation. And where before we were feeling bliss, we were feeling joy, suddenly it may feel worse to us because it's such a beautiful experience, it opens us up on every level. And then the harsh realities, so to speak, of the world come tumbling in on us. And we may feel somewhat helpless or defenseless against that. And so we should always guard those experiences from that standpoint. We should try to allow time to more gently move into the world if we can possibly do that. It's not always possible to have that occur. Through repeated contact, the mind becomes more purified and more steady. If we can keep our mind focused on that contact point within the self, that place of stillness, that place of peace or joy that we're experiencing in that meditative state, we will find that that grows stronger. As that grows stronger, that will continue to be in our consciousness even when we move out into the world. So that we can be interacting with other people, we can be talking with them, we can be conducting business or doing a variety of duties, and still we have that feeling of the presence within us. Now, one way to think about it, if we are moving in the world, but we don't have that feeling of peace or that bliss, is just to acknowledge within the mind that we couldn't move. The very life force that's flowing through our body that allows us to walk, allows us to talk, to allow us to think, that is God as well. By validating and acknowledging continuously that what exists within us is God, as well as that which exists outside of us, every person that we meet is God in human form. Through that practice, we gradually purify the mind more and more, to the point where we can carry that experience with us always. When we can enter into that perfectly, always carrying that state of presence, always carrying that bliss and that peace, we have then attained Sahaja Samadhi. And that is our ultimate goal in our practice and our sadhana. So that whatever happens in this world, good or bad, high or low, we experience that presence and that inner guidance of the divine. So the short answer in your question, perhaps, is that there is just this period of time where we don't have the strength and the purity of mind to retain that consciousness always. The good news is that the misery that that produces reminds us that we've stepped outside of that consciousness, and if we're wise, if we're smart, we quickly return back to that divine consciousness. And so in the beginning it comes sporadically, occasionally. With intensity of practice, it comes more and more constantly. And so any time that we fall out of that consciousness, it should be a reminder to us to get back to our practice, get back to it, and move back to it. And if we're always getting back to it, always moving back to it, doing our chanting, doing our meditating, affirming that everything is God. As I move, that is God within me moving. And it's a beautiful thing. If you think about it, as you walk through the world and you feel that the life force that is walking through your legs, that's moving through your arms, that's breathing through you, is God, you get a sense of peace, you get a sense of bliss, an upliftment. Focusing on that presence always. As Mother says, it's an earned experience. And as she described it, you earn a certain amount of experience by climbing up the mountainside. And you can stay there on some peak for a certain amount of time, and then that which you have earned is fulfilled, and you have to go back down into the valley again. And you earn a larger experience in order to go and stay for a longer period of time. It's really so heartbreaking when we're up in that uplifted state and we feel ourselves being pulled down almost very much in spite of ourselves. It's not what we want. But down goes the mind, down goes the mind. And one thing about it is that it helps to convince the mind that this is not a fantasy that we're dealing with. It's not imagination. Because the power of that experience is so profound when we're in it. We know it. We know the truth of it. We know the reality of it. And when we're brought down almost in spite of ourselves, that too is a profound reality. And it begins to convince the mind through and through that what we're experiencing is a spiritual reality. And it's profound, and it's meaningful, and it's transforming of our consciousness. So, until we have that perfect, steady, contemplative mind, or sadhana. And we never know how close or how far we are from the goal. How close that purity of mind is. And we should always hold in our mind not all of our frailties, which we know all too well, not all of our limitations, which are too present in our mind oftentimes, but always to hold in our mind that that perfection already exists inside of us. It's just a matter of the mind being able to receive it and accept it and to identify with it completely. And who knows when that can happen in a moment, in a flash. It could come to the point where it receives it completely and then never again moves in or out, but is always in that state of consciousness. So this idea that Papa Ramdas talks about so convincingly about grace, that grace is always present, always ready to uplift you. And for us to open our minds to that, open our hearts to that, what a wonderful thing. Because one of the problems we run into is thinking that we are the doer. And that's as prevalent in doing our sadhana as anything else that we do. Ah, aren't I being a good devotee? That's usually a thought that precedes going for a good tumble. So, you know, it's just so subtle that the way that these thoughts of separation come in. And that's where thinking that God does everything is so perfect, because it takes you out of the sense of doership. That when it's God who's doing the sadhana, God who does everything through you, thinks everything through you, and you are the witness, there's no, it's like putting Teflon onto the consciousness, and there's no place for the ego to grab hold to. It just slips off, just slides off. And so to just constantly affirm in your mind, it is God. And if you feel bad, if you feel separated, if you feel difficulties in your life, then just think that is God too. And the wonderful thing about it is just like creating a little short circuit that takes you right around the problem and connects you right back in with God. Because what the mind tries to do is tries to place that problem between you as the observer and God as the omniscient consciousness. And says, well, I can never experience God consciousness because I have this problem. I have this difficulty. And bang, right there, that separation is put into place. But when you think God is this difficulty and he's orchestrating it, he's organizing it for my highest good, you just did an end run around that difficulty, and it cannot serve as a barrier, as a separation. If we have pain in our body, we just say, that's God coming to me as pain in my body. We just do a short circuit right around that. It cannot serve then as a barrier, as a separation. And if we do that with every aspect of our lives, not thinking, oh, I would be a better devotee, or I would meditate better if I didn't have all these things to do, and if I didn't have such a busy life, and if I didn't have so many difficulties or problems. No, that's God who's come as those difficulties, as those problems, as that pain. Whatever the situation is, that is the infinite. And why? All geared towards awakening us. All geared towards making us know that we are one with the divine. And it's a brilliant move to take away any power of idea of separation. And when we do that, we do connect ourselves directly to God. And suddenly we feel safe in those hands. We feel safe in that experience. We feel whole and complete, connected with the ultimate divine consciousness. It's a beautiful thing.
The negative thing doesn't necessarily go away, does it? It's just like you say pain.
Right.
It doesn't necessarily go away. It just, you see it a different way. And so it, if you see it as God's barrier or God's lesson or God's obstacle, then it's can be a joyful thing.
Yes.
Even though it's still there.
Yes, yeah. The ego can get involved with thinking, well, if I think it's God, then it won't hurt anymore, or won't be a difficulty anymore. And the sense of doership sneaks right in there, which of course creates an idea of separation in there. And so the relief comes when we think, this is God who's coming to me as this difficulty or this pain or whatever it is that's coming to us, that connection with God then brings with it a sense of peace, a sense of completeness in ourselves. We no longer feel separate. So much fear comes to us from the idea of separation because we're afraid that things can be taken away from us. But when we feel our connectedness with God, then what can be taken away from us? Because we always have that sense of oneness with Him. So things may be able to be taken away from us. Even health can be taken away from us. But God can't be. And because of that connection, we get a sense of peace. We get a sense of wholeness. And that is our healing. That is, you know, wonderful story in the Mahabharata, which was the mother of all the Pandus. After all the battle and all the difficulties, and her sons regained their kingdom once again, she prayed to Krishna and she said, Krishna, when we had all these difficulties and my sons were out in the wilderness and they didn't have their kingship, we thought of you all the time. You are never absent from us because we were in difficulty and it was a hardship. My prayer to you is that you always give me difficulties. Because then my mind is always fixed on you. So that's a reversal of thinking of what the human mind wants to do, which is take away all of my difficulties. Of course, what I would prefer is the direct prayer is, give me remembrance of you always.
And then it can be either.
And then it can be either. It can be high or low. You're not praying. You don't have to put on the hair shirt and go out and punish yourself constantly. But you can live and reside in that consciousness, whatever it is. And of course, that's how Mother taught us, is that you enjoy life. Life is meant to be enjoyed.
It's important to have days of thankfulness, though, so that you do recognize that the gifts are coming from God as
yes.
well. And so it's not just waiting around till some catastrophe mm-hmm. reminds you of.
One of my recommendations for people who are experiencing depression is to make a gratitude list each night. And it's amazing how difficult it sometimes is when you're feeling very badly to come up with even one thing that you feel grateful for. But my insistence is that they come up with at least three things they feel grateful for. And through having that gratitude list for at least 30 days, it changes the mood. You start looking for things to be grateful for during the day because you want to have something at the end of the day, where before you may have just really struggled with having even one thing. Well, as soon as you're looking for good things, of course, you start drawing good things to yourself. And your mind starts to take on a positive charge instead of the negative charge all the time. So the moment we're grateful for whatever comes to us, and St. Francis was a wonderful, everything was a brother or sister. And sometimes it was pain, and it was sister pain coming. And it was every living thing had a purpose and had a meaning. And what a wonderful way to live our lives when that's the case. Nothing lies outside of our deepest meaning about life and how that transforms our life when we're able to really live in that, constantly affirm it. One of the things I'm feeling grateful for is our spiritual family. And just feeling such bliss and such love for you all. And all those of our spiritual family that are in other places. How wonderful it is to have that connection, that we can travel together. And our connection with the great spiritual masters. You know, we can think that these masters, well, they lived at another time and I never knew them. My experience has taught me is that they are very knowable. That we can know them. We can know their spirits. We can feel their influence. We can be receivers of their blessings. And it's not that we need intermediaries between ourselves and God, but they are God come in a personal form. That's quite unique, quite wonderful. At one time I was reading a book about submarines and the submarine detectors, those people who operated the radars. If a certain boat came, they knew it because of the vibration that boat produced when its engines were in the water and propellers and so forth. And they called that a signature. And they could just listen to the noise and they knew what boat it was if they've met it before. I thought of the spiritual masters and when they've come to me at different times. And you recognize their signature. There's a vibration. There's a feeling about them. It's pure God, and yet it has a personal aspect to it. So it has both. It's the purity of God consciousness, and it's the peculiarity of their individuality. Many of the times, and I know for you, you have also felt their influence. And it's uplifting, and it's powerful, and it's wonderful. Feel the power of these great masters who are nothing but your true self in reality, nothing but pure God. And yet it is God's great joy to play through his personalities. Sri Yukteswar talked about the graduations that they have in the astral heaven where he teaches. And that God assumes a variety of forms based on what the particular devotee's individuality brings to him. And it's God's joy. This world is ananda. It is joy. And it is through our idea of separation that we have come to believe it to be otherwise. But when we connect with that joy, we connect with the divine infinite. And the great masters who are one with that divine presence, whether it be Jesus or Buddha or Muhammad or Mother or Master, Papa, Lahari Mahasya, Sri Yukteswar, any of them at all, Babaji. And when you become so imbued with their presence, you realize that there is no separation between the self that is within them and the self that is within you. Because you have that same purity, that same connection, that same light within your own being. And even as I speak, I feel their presence. in this room at this time. And what a blessing that is. So my gratitude goes to each one of you. My thoughts of love. And my desire to see your spiritual growth. For you to grow in your understanding. In your capacity to know that presence and be one with that presence always. It will be our true fulfillment and completion when that is with us always. So open your mind, your heart, and your soul. Love God with every ounce of your being. And you will receive that which you cherish most. Will you please pray with me? O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for thee. I kneel in adoration at thy feet and surrender myself to thee. I feel the power of thy perfection surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence are radiant with thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss of my communion with thee. I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am he. Said that the submarines had radar detectors. Of course, they have sonar detectors.
There's probably a couple of people in the room that caught that, but most of them.
Reminds me of a cute story I just read that a little boy of a minister was watching his dad prepare a sermon for the next Sunday. And he says, Dad, he says, how do you know what to say? And the minister father says, well, son, he says, God tells me what to say. The little boy looked consternated for a little bit, and he says, well, why do you keep crossing things out then? Ha, ha, ha.